Chat window. So welcome all to the November 17th Q&A for the Ottawa PC User Group. Anybody who's new to us, by all means, feel free to join in on any of our meetings. We hope you find something productive in here. You can feel free to enter information, either questions or comments, into the chat, or you'll have the ability to unmute yourself. I will mute everybody right now. And you do have the ability to unmute yourself if you wanted to make a comment or ask a question. Please remute yourself after doing so, so that we keep background noise to the minimum. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to kick off the deck for tonight.
Okay, thanks, Chris. The first slide should be on the screen.
Yep.
Welcome, everyone. And we have a pretty full agenda tonight, so we'll see how we go. We have lots of interesting stuff, I think. And we're going to start off with Chris asking a question.
Yeah, okay. So Windows 11, it rolled out as general availability on October 5th, and people started getting the notices that it's available. And if you go to the next build there, Alan, I happen to have a pop-up come onto my computer that said, my PC is able to run Windows 11, and they were getting it ready for me. And my initial question was, do I really want it? And I thought about it, and then all of a sudden I have a Windows Update update. So one day, just a couple of days ago, Windows Update announced that it was ready for me, and I could download and install it. So I ask again, do I want it? Think about that, because at the end of tonight's Q&A, we're actually going to have a poll about how many people have actually moved to Windows 11 or considering moving to Windows 11 or bound and determined to stick with what they've got. So we'll have a poll. And also, I am quite interested in knowing, you know, how many people are running Windows 11 and what are your thoughts about whether it's a worthwhile update, a mandatory update, something that should be avoided, just what people are thinking about. And so stay tuned for that later on in the hour.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Well, as Chris says, we'll come back to that. In the meantime, I have a quick share. I was trying to zip up a bunch of PDF files, and you might be able to read here. I'm actually trying to create an archive of more than 2,000 files. I would normally use PZIP to do this, a freeware program, but my recollection is it told me that was way too many files and it couldn't possibly do that. So I fell back to the Windows built-in zip application, whereby you basically highlight what you want to zip, right-click, and you can see here I right-click, but there's nowhere to create a compressed file on the context menu. So I thought that was a bit odd. So I checked on the website, and I eventually found an entry which says that, go and look in this folder, in the users subfolder, app data, roaming, yada, yada, until you get to send to. And you basically have a list of all the options which should be in that right click context menu. And you can see there that it compressed files and sending things to fax recipients. They're all there. But notice that there are two entries for Bluetooth. There's the real one, Bluetooth device, which is 2K. And there's a spurious one, just called Bluetooth, which has 0 kilobytes. And apparently, if you end up with that, and goodness knows, that's supposed to come from some Windows update somewhere. But apparently, if you end up with that in that menu, it prevents the display of all the other options, and you can only see Bluetooth. So basically, all you have to do is delete this spurious entry right here, and then next time you right-click and you choose Send To, you will be able to create the zip file. So if that ever happens to you, that's basically the fix. Okay, so moving along, Chris has a share, also has a share, and this one's quite interesting, a new function from Rogers.
Yeah, I got a notice, I think it was in an email or something, about the fact that I could turn on advanced security in my Rogers Ignite Wi-Fi hub And I figure there's probably a number of people in our group that are actually Rogers customers and might be using their Ignite Wi-Fi hub. So a quote from them, it provides added protection against online threats for your connected home with real-time monitoring of your home Wi-Fi network and automatic alerts for suspicious activities. And I'm pasting into the chat window the URLs. Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah, I got the next one as well. So what does it say? I went to the website and looked for more details. And so it said it prevents unauthorized Wi-Fi access attempts. So people outside of the Wi-Fi network that are trying to access devices on my network, so on the private side. It says it also can look at suspicious site visits. So devices on my network that are trying to visit a potentially malicious site. So there are a number of ways that, you know security providers can actually determine that a site is potentially malicious, and presumably this will actually block it. Suspicious device activity, smart devices that deviate from normal behavior. They don't talk about what is normal behavior, but who knows? Targeted network attacks. So some device on my network that actually gets infected and it tries to participate in, say, a distributed denial of service attack or something like that. I don't know how they determine that, but they say they do. And then IP reputation threats. So this is devices from an unknown source trying to access a device connected to my Wi-Fi network. Now, quite frankly, I think that by and large, that should be blocked anyways. No devices outside of my network should be trying to access a device that is connected on my private side. But that's what the way they describe it. So they say they will do monitoring for intrusions from websites that contain malware, phishing, and so forth. Unauthorized access attempts to the smart devices from hackers. Again, I think that that should be blocked anyways. I mean, no unsolicited inbound connection should actually get past my router anyhow, but they say they will do that. And then they talk about the fact that all the devices that are connected on your private side of your network are covered. So whether it's computers, tablets, smartphones, your refrigerator that's internet connected or whatever, it'll automatically cover all of these additional devices. So, you know, I thought that sounds pretty cool. They say they will block automatically suspicious activity in real time. Real time is good. I mean, we don't want them to block it the next day. Preventing you from inadvertently visiting malicious sites. So that, again, is where it will have a list of known bad sites and block you from getting to those, presumably. Unauthorized access attempts from open ports. I don't know what they really mean by that, but okay. Suspicious device activity, so that again is where it's deviating from its normal behavior. Doesn't really talk about exactly what it's doing or how it's doing it. And then that attempts to participate in network attacks like distributed denial of service attacks. So it'll block all of those automatically. It's not anything that you can control and be granular on. Say, well, I want this, but I don't want this. It's all or nothing. And then it'll inform you. So you can get alerts when you have devices that are behaving in unusual ways. It'll give you a review of digital security related actions from the past 7 days. So on the device, you can actually go on and you can see what actions were taken by the device. And you can do that either having it go to your smartphone app, which basically if you're a Rogers Ignite Wi-Fi hub user, you really have to have the smartphone app installed anyways to really do a lot of the things. So you can do it through there, or you can actually go to their website from any browser and look up things on there. You do have that option to push the notifications to your phone, and that is whether you're using the smartphone app or not, I believe. I'm not 100% sure. And then there is the option to allow for certain blocked activities to be overridden. So if you decide that, hey, something is getting blocked, but I know what it is and I know it's not malicious, and therefore I'm going to allow it, you can actually apparently override those blocks. So I think, is that it? Yeah. So that's it. I turned it on. I haven't had any notices of anything happening on my network. Are my devices being blocked or anything like that? So I really don't know if it's doing anything useful. I will report back anytime that I do find that it has actually saved my bacon or caused me grief. Until then, if you feel like this potentially added security, by all means, check it out.
Bob Harris says he has Rogers Home Internet, and it sounds great. So thank you, Chris. and there's nothing else in the chat. If anybody has any questions for Chris, put them in the chat window, and we'll get back to them later on. And yep. Or just contact Chris directly by email.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, for now, we have a follow-up from the last Q&A session, or the one before that, actually, because Stefan had a problem with his mic, and that he's now fixed. So we're going to go on and call on Stefan to give us his pitch on storage in the cloud. So this is part two, how to use cloud storage. So if you want to take control, Stefan, it's over to you.
Okay. I will start sharing my screen. So you should see the presentation.
That's good.
Okay. So in part one, I covered container storage and cloud storage basic, and we look at some common cloud storage providers. We look at iCloud, Google Drive, Microsoft OneDrive, Dropbox, and Box. So I pick one of those. I pick Google Drive, and I will show you how we can use the various functions or things that you can do with cloud storage. I will look at how to create an account, uploading and downloading file and folder using a browser, sharing a file or folder using a link, and installing and using the sync software. This one will be specific to Google. All of these will be specific to Google Drive, but I suspect that it's very similar to all these other cloud storage provider. So the first thing you need to do if you want to use Google Drive is to create a Google account or a Gmail account. If you have one, you have nothing to do, it's already there for you. You just need to use it. I will show you how to do that. If you don't have one, here's the link you can go to create a Google account, and it will create at the same time give you a Gmail account, but it will create also the Google Drive information. To access Google Drive, there is various ways you can do that. If you log into your Gmail account and you go at the top right of your screen, you will see this icon here that look like nine dots in rows and stuff like that. These are the Google apps. If you click on that, you get a very long list of Google apps that you can get access. And one of them, it may not be in the same place on your screen, but if you look, you will find Google Drive. Now, if you click on that, it will open a new tab, and you will basically be your main screen for your Google Drive. So I suggest that you bookmark that page so you can return to it very easily, or you can just browse to the URL that is indicated there. And if you're not already logged in into your Google account, it will ask you for your credentials, like your Google email and your password. Now we're going to look at more details at that main screen. So the first thing we're going to look at is the various things on the left of the screen. So you can see there is something called My Drive, so we'll cover that in a few minutes. If you have a computer that are linked to that account, they will show up on their computer. So when you install the software to sync, the computer will appear under there. The next item is item that I share with you. So sometimes people will send you a Google Drive link, and these things will give you access to their file on their Google Drive. They will show up on the under that heading. If you click on that, you will see all of these things that people have shared with you. The next one, recent, is just the recent file that you have added. The star is the rating mechanism that Google Drive is using. Trash is your trash can, basically. And the important thing is this thing at the bottom here, how much information you are using. So here I'm using 182 megabytes or 15 gigabytes. And like I explained in part one, if you need more than 15, you need to buy storage. So you can keep an eye on this bar here and make sure that you're not getting close to using all the free space that you have. Now, if we take a look at the bottom of the screen, this is a pop-up that is generated. It's basically asking you if you want to get a notification of important event. If you want that, you just click turn on. If you don't want it, click the X, but it will reappear. I don't know how many times, but it's still showing up for me. The next thing we're going to look at the top of the screen here. And if you click on My Drive, you get a long list of items that you can do. And we'll come back to some of these things because you can create a new folder if you want to regroup your files. Anything you're doing on your computer, you can create a folder and put some of your files on your Google Drive in the same, on that folder. Upload file. So you can click on there, and I will show you that in a few minutes. You can also upload complete folder if you want, so you can do that. And the rest of the things are various items that you can create directly on your Google Drive. Most of these, in fact, all of them that you see right now are Google apps that create like documents, spreadsheets, slides, and forms, and all kinds of other things. The next part of the screen is called the suggested. So that's something that is automatically generated by Google Drive. It shows you the things that you think you may want to see on your, that you have already stored on your Google Drive that you're interested to see again. If you don't like that, you can click on the setting button on the top right. And at the way, way down on the first, on the general settings, all the way down, you will see two things that you can control if you want to see the suggested item in My Drive and the suggested item in your share that I'll share with you. So if you remove these two check marks, that section will completely disappear from your layout and you will never see it again. If you find it useful, you can pick which one you want or leave it like this if you like that. The next section is the file section if you want. So we'll look at that. So here I created two folders. So one I call presentation public and another one video public. So this is for me to indicate to me that these are things that I want to share with other people. If I wanted to create a folder to store some personal file I would have created, I would not have put the public name in it. And by default, Google Drive create this getting started PDF. So it's like if you open that file, it will show how to use basically Google Drive. On the far right of the screen, so this comes alive when you click on a specific file. So if you click on the file, you can click on the activity and it will show you what you have, the various things that have happened on that file. So on September 8th, I share that expense access database. And the way I shared it is anyone on the internet with the link. And I will show you how to do that in a couple of slides. On September 8th, just prior to that, I've uploaded the item. So you can get all the various activities that you have done. And instead of activities, if you click on details, you get the details on that specific file. So the name on the file is that expense access database that I put on my Google Drive. So the first thing he's telling you is who has access. So that's really important to make sure that you always know who has access to your file. The first S is me, basically. And that next icon shows basically that anyone that I give the internet link can view that file, basically. And after that, it's very similar information as you get from your File Explorer on Windows or any OS. You get the size and the date and all kinds of stuff like that. And the unknown file type is just from the perspective of Google Drive, because that's a known file type for Microsoft. Now, if you want to upload a file to Google Drive, a file or a folder, so you go and click on My Drive, and you get the menu, and you either create a new folder to put them there, or if you don't, just upload them at the root, if you want, of your Google Drive, you just right-click, you click on the upload file, and when you click on that, you will get a dialog box that is looks familiar. It's basically you select which file that you want to upload to your Google Drive. So don't do what the cartoon was showing, to throw a filing cabinet in the air. It won't work. So you can select one or many files, and you click open, but it's not really opening the file. What it will do is upload the file to your Google Drive using your internet connection and move it to the cloud. At the bottom right of your screen, while you're doing that, it will be a progress bar that is will be showing the progress of uploading the files, all the files that you're trying to upload. So you will see that bar progressing depending on how fast your internet connection is. On this one, it was so fast I didn't have the time to see the progression bar. I just saw that the upload was done, basically. If I go and click on that file that I just updated, that was the presentation for the part one. So the details, I didn't give access to anyone, and the PowerPoint, the size and stuff like that. When you have a file, if you right click on that file, you have a very long list of menu items that you can do. The first one is preview, so it will open the Google Viewer that is associated with that on a new tab in your browser. You can decide to open with, and you will get very similar to Windows, a list of applications. You can open it. We'll come back to these two. This is all you can share and get the link for that file if you want to share it with other people. Show file location will just basically show you in which folder it is on your Google Drive. You can add a shortcut to that drive someplace else. You can move that file. If you want to use the star, the way to give stars to your files, you can do that there. You can rename the file. Manage version is you can upload many files under the same name, and Google Drive will keep all of these versions if you want, and you can pick which one you want to download. And even though you add a new version to a file, the download link that you may have given to people will still work. So basically the link still points to that file, but behind this, Google Drive keep many versions of these files. So if you click on that, you get a dialog box that lists all the version that you have, and you can pick which one you want to download. You can make a copy. You can report an abuse if it's a link that you got from someone, or if you want to download that file to your computer, you can click on download. Or if you want, you don't need it anymore, you can remove it, and it goes to your trash bin. Now, if you want to share, you need to determine who gets the link and what they can do with it. So you can determine the who by name. And by name, basically, it's Gmail email addresses. And the user will need to be signed in their Google account to be able to access the file. If you put a non-Gmail email as an address that you want to share, the Google Drive will warn you that anyone that get access to the link, because it will send an invitation, I will show you that in a few minutes, anyone that get a copy of that, or you forward that to them and they click on that link, you will get access. Okay. So if you want to have more security, make sure that you share with people that have a Gmail address. You can also do group. If it's you're sharing files with the same list of people very often. So in order to do that, you need to go and go in Google Contact. It's another application, and you create a group there, and you add members, basically email address, to that group. And after that, you can reference that group in the link when you're creating the link. When you do the who using a link, there is two two modes. The first one is the restricted, i.e. he wants to see a list of names. So basically what I described earlier with the who by name. Or it works in a mode that anyone with the link, so anyone that get that link, get access to the file that you have, that you were pointing to. Now we need to determine what they can do. So there is three things that they can do. So the first thing is you can give them the role, if you want, a viewer. So that means that they can view the file and download it. If you want to give them a bit more access, you can give them the role of commenter. They can do everything that a viewer can do, and they can leave a comment. So you can do that if you don't want the people to edit the file, but they can leave you comments to say, oh, you made a typo on slide, whatever, or no, this is incorrect, change it to that, or something like that. And the last one, it's an editor. So an editor can obviously view, download, leave comments, but at the same time, he can edit the file, he can manage version, and as I explained before, if you can manage version, that does not change the link. You can select which file, which version is going to be used when you click on the link. Now, if you want to share a file, so you right-click and you recall these two options here, share and get the link. So if you click on the first one, share, with the small people with a plus sign, so you get that window that pop up. So it says share with people and groups, and you can see where you can type to add people and groups. This will show your name because you're the you will be the owner of that file. And once you have added these names, we'll show you what happens. So when you begin typing names, the things become alive. So first, you recognize if you type a Gmail and name, you will put the name of the people, and that box here will appear. So this is where you can choose what role you want to give to these people. So right now, I think by default, you choose editor, but you could go and say, I just want to give them the role of viewer or commenter, whatever you want them to do. Here, you can choose if you want whoever you put that long list of names that you put there, you can, if you want to notify them with an email, you can put a check mark there, and you can type a message to say, hi group or hi Bob or whatever name you send it to say, oh, here's the file I talk about, or please make change or look at the file, depending what role you give them. And it will show you which file you're working with. And when you're ready, you click send, and Google Drive will send these email as you indicated on the list. And this is when I was talking about, see, if you use an email that is not a Gmail account, that's when you will get that warning that telling you that anyone that get a copy of that email, either they're forwarded to them, something like that, by clicking that link, they will get access, even though they are not, may not be the person that you put on the list. If you click on the other one to get the link, it will show you the link that is generated to get access. You can copy that link and put it, and this will put it in the clipboard, so you can put it in other email or documents that you want to use. And right now it's in the mode that anyone with the link. So that link here, as soon as you send that link to people, anyone that has that link will be able to have this role. So right now that role will be the viewer, but you can pick whatever role you want. So if you want to put, for example, the movie that you want to share with a bunch of people, that's probably the easiest thing to do. You probably do not care who get access to that video, but if you do, you need to use the other mode where you can add the name and group of people you want to share that information with. The link that is done by Google Drive is not a download link. So when you get that link and you click on it, Google Drive will try to open the file in the associated Google app in your browser. From there, you can obviously look at the file, but you can download it. If you don't want that, you want the people to, basically when they click on the link, it will download the file. You need to change that link. So it's not hard to do. You need to follow the process that I described before to get the link, and you copy the link, so now the link will be in your clipboard. Open a test editor, like Notepad will do great. Paste the link, in Notepad and look for the object ID, and it's in gold in that link below. So it starts after the /, and all of these are the unique document ID, and it stops at the / here. So you need to copy that information there, and you need to create a new link which looks something like this. So drive.google.com, and when you have the object ID here, you replace it with that string there, and this is what you give to people, and when they open that link, automatically it will download the file. So if I modify that link to be a download link, so people can use that basically, and it will automatically download the file. Now, to download the Sync software, Google is in the process of changing the name of their software. So, but they still offer two software suite to do the syncing, to get the sync software. The first one is called targeted for individual, Drive for desktop. So you can choose folder on your computer to sync with Google Drive, or backup to Google Photo and access all of your content directly from your PC and Mac. So we'll show you that. The next one is mainly for team and organization, and this one is called Drive for your team. And teams can utilize shared drive where a file belongs to the team instead of a specific individual. So everybody that is in the team can access it, basically. But you need to have Google Space, and this costs $8 US per month per user. So it's mainly corporation and stuff like that that would be using this. So how to get the Drive for desktop, you need to click on the setting icon in Google Drive, so that will be located at the top right or on your screen, on your browser. The screen on mine, when I put the presentation together, said get backup and sync for Windows. This is the old name for that software. And in fact, when I did that presentation, it was the first time I did it. When I was clicking on that link, it was bringing me to the download page, and I was able to download backup and sync. When I updated when Chris mentioned to me that no, that's the new software, so I went back and I tried again. Even though it was showing me get the backup and sync for Windows. In fact, it bring me to a download page for Drive for desktop. So I guess Google is still in the process of updating their various page for that, but hopefully it will be all in sync at one point in time. So when you do that, the software will bring you to a web page with like download the software, and the process will start right away. And you can tell them if you want to add an application shortcut on your desktop, as many application installation program do. So you can put a check mark there if you want that. And you add a desktop shortcut to your Google Drive. So if you put that, it will, when you click open that shortcut, it will bring you straight to your drive. So you can decide what you want to do, and after that, you click install. And during the installation, you may need to provide your Google information account, depending if you're already logged in or not. And if you click on your desktop, a new icon will appear, and this is the icon for Google Drive. So if you click on there, you get first a status. Everything is up to date. Obviously, you have not put anything in yet, so everything will be up to date. But if it's not, it will show you what it's doing, basically. You can figure out the most recent file activity here. Your username and information will appear here. And you can determine if you want to get notification or not when you're doing things by using Google Drive. This icon here, you can go to the settings, and this folder bring you to your Google Drive. Another thing that happened when you install that software on your Windows workstation, so this is a screenshot of the File Explorer in Windows, it will create a new drive, and it will call it Google Drive. The default for that drive is J. And this is the content, basically. My drive is basically that My Drive there is the My Drive I showed you earlier on your Google Drive. So if you double click on that, you can begin to copy file there. And as soon as you copy a file in that folder and you create folders, that kind of stuff, automatically it will be uploaded and synced with your Google Drive. And if you have two workstations that have that installed, automatically it will begin to appear also on these other workstations because it will download it from Google Drive. Even though you see files there, it will not, the file is not really there. So when you click on it and you want to edit it, it's only at that time that Google Drive will go and download it from Google Drive. If you want to have a copy, you can just right click on the file and you can select if you want the file to be available offline. So this allows you to keep working on the file even though you don't have an internet connection, which can happen sometimes. Click on My Drive, you will see the Google Drive file and folder. I explained that. You can also get there through your File Explorer. So I'll show you that. The G drive is the default. You can change that if you don't want that, if you want to put it in a different drive letter. And as I just explained, because you're seeing a list of files there, it's just a directory listing. The actual files are not downloaded to your computers. So it's only when you click on it, unless you can change the property of that specific file and say that you want it to be available offline. So that's it for the how to use Google Drive. Any questions?
I don't think we have anything in the chat right now. So if people have any questions, you could unmute yourself and ask, or put it into the chat, or we can revisit it if you think of something over the next little bit. One thing that I'll comment on with Google Drive, one thing I like to do is I create a folder on my Google Drive called Public, and that is the only place that I will share files so that I don't accidentally start sharing files that are in some I share some folder and then I put a private file in it that I don't intend to share, forgetting that I've actually shared that folder. So by doing it this way, I prevent that sort of thing from happening. I'll take one folder, I will share that folder, and then that's the only place that I will actually share any files on my Google Drive. And I find it really helps to keep that guardrails between private and public information.
That's probably a good idea. Jocelyn just mentioning that one of the nice things about Google Drive is you can decide who can view and edit your files. She says, but be careful how you set those rights, because you might get a nasty surprise if more people can see the file that you think. So when you have your public folder, Chris, do you give everybody any all rights?
I give them view only. And if they want to modify anything, they can download it, because they do have the ability to download if they can see it. And so I don't allow them to modify any of my files at all.
Now, Stefan, Tom is noting that Drive is convenient for sharing with the phone. You have any comments on that?
I guess if you're on your phone, if it's an Android phone, you already have your Google account on it. So after that, if you go and get that application for your phone, you will get access to your Google Drive. So this is how you can get access to files that you want to share with other people, or file that you need can be accessible on your phone. If you don't do that, you need, for example, if you want to bring a file to your phone, you need to either plug a USB cable, or send it to you via email, and after that, download it to your phone. So the Google Drive allows you to bypass all of this, and the file is just there when you need it.
Yeah, I pointed out its use for getting the vaccine certificates onto your phone by putting them into your Google Drive, and then it automatically shows up on your phone. You tell it to make it available offline on your phone, and then you create a shortcut on your home screen, And that to me was the simplest way of getting my vaccine certificate accessible on the phone. Tristan mentions as well, Office 365 Family Bundle has a great deal, and it is a great deal. You can have up to, I think it's 6 people on your account, and each one of them get a terabyte of storage in OneDrive. The one caution about that is you may sort of lock yourself into forever subscribing to Office 365 because, say you're 1 or 2 years into it and you've got about 5 terabytes of files up in the cloud, and then you decide you want to stop subscribing to it, well, that can be a problem for you. just a little bit of a caution on that. So.
One thing I was wondering, is there a way to check who has rights on any particular file on Google Drive? Is there a way to audit or something like that?
The only way I've ever seen is to go to each individual file and you can check the security on or the any sharing that has been done on it. Stefan, do you know of a way of auditing all your files on Google Drive at once or?
I'm not aware of any, it's what I showed on the deck that you need to go and look. If you look at that file, you can get who has access on that file.
Yeah.
And
And keep in mind that it's on folders as well. And that's why I just put a share on one folder. And then, you know, anything I put in there can get shared with anybody who has the link to the folder, as well as I could give people the links to individual files. If I know that they're not interested in anything else that happens to be there, I can just get a link for an individual file as well. So it's handy.
Yeah, Google Drive has been very useful also for any group of people that need to share things. For example, our own computer club has share folders. Let us have meetings and share the contents of the minutes and things like that. So in the COVID-19 era, that has been a very useful thing to have.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks, Stefan. There's several comments in the chat window saying it's very useful information. So really appreciate you putting all that information together. And I just remind everybody, especially the people who are new to the Q&A sessions, that the various files that we have from tonight, the PowerPoint files and the audio recording, the contents of the chat window, they will all be posted to the PCUG website. So if you look at the Q&A page from the home screen, you'll find all the relevant information. Okay, so moving along, Chris has another interesting share.
If people who know me over the years have known that I've had a love-hate relationship with Windows Update. Generally works really, really well, but occasionally you do get problems. And just recently, I happened to have a problem where Windows Update complained about an update to .NET Core. And it was said downloaded it, and then as soon as it started on the installing, it said error encountered. And I tried the retry, of course, and that didn't help. I tried some of my other go-to methods for fixing Windows cleanup, going to disk cleanup, and one of the options in there under system files is to clean up Windows Update cleanup, and I tried that, didn't help. I tried my nuclear option of resetting Windows Update, which basically blows away all of the database of all what it knows about what's been done and so forth, and reinitializes things, and I pasted into the chat window those two URLs, which are to PDFs of previous Q&A sessions we had on cleaning up Windows Update, and none of it worked for me. And I tried over days. I pulled out the big guns going to Google search, and I had, you know, all kinds of hits on things, and specifically looking for that particular error message, the 800-706-43, and also looking on specifically that particular module that was being updated, .NET Core. And one of them was running Windows Update Troubleshooter. That never fixed anything for me anytime I tried it. it's not a bad thing to try because it only takes you a couple of minutes to do it, and it will check for some of the components that are required for Windows Update to work properly to see if they're running and so forth. The last one on the slide there, you know, somebody actually suggested doing an in-place upgrade repair install, and no thanks. I'm not going to that sort of extent. So, I just sort of waited, and because there is the old story, when it hurts to bang your head against the wall, sometimes the best thing to do is stop banging your head against the wall. And interestingly enough, a couple of weeks later, I had a Windows update for .NET Core. The original problem was trying to update to 3.1.17 that failed. And then magically, I got an update that was to .NET Core 3.1.21, and it installed successfully. So I think it was worth going through the steps of the standard steps of trying to fix Windows Update, but I should have stopped as soon as I got to those. They weren't working, and I should have known to just wait and see if something magically comes through that fixes the problem, and sure enough, it did.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so I have another part of my looking at abandoning Windows forever session coming up. And you may have noticed in the chat window, I pointed out that none of my computers are going to upgrade to Windows 11. So in terms of Windows, I'm sticking with Windows 10 because there's nowhere to go. But this thing is looking at, could I move to Linux completely and abandon Windows forever? And it's interesting, there's a whole bunch of people looking at the same thing. Anybody who knows Linus Tech Tips, Linus Sebastian from Vancouver, and one of his buddies, Luke, are doing a month challenge where they have to run their personal computer on Linux and nothing else. Otherwise, they have to dye their hair in the Windows logo colors forever and ever, I think. And it's a really interesting series. They haven't got much video coverage on the web yet, but the first part of the challenge was to download a distro, install it, and run a game. And Linus had a lot of problems with a couple of different distros, whereas Luke ran Linux Mint, hooray, and basically breezed through the whole thing. So it's really quite interesting. And some of the follow-ups that people, Linux users, have done, kind of critiquing or commenting on the videos, have been really quite interesting. They kind of point out it's not necessarily Linus's fault. The kind of errors which he made were kind of understandable to a new user. If you want something really basic, then Christopher Barnett, who does this explainingcomputers.com series on YouTube, has a set of things on Linux Survival Guide. These are really basic introductions to installing and using Linux, and he has a very dry sense of humor, so you might like that if you're interested in Linux at all. And recently, Micheline on the users forum posted this article from Jack Waller, who again is running a series on how to switch from Linux to Windows, and he's looking at it as a dual boot or a trial type situation where you don't actually have to install Linux to try it out, which is one of the things I highly recommend. It's very easy to just download a distro, burn it to a USB drive, boot from it, use it, and you'll soon find out whether it's any use or not to you. Anyway, here's the story so far. We looked at a bunch of things, and I have to go back and revisit Excel because I wasn't able to do much macro programming, which right at the moment I need to do. But all the other things so far have been good. And now I want to look at using digital image management software. And in the Windows world, I use a freeware program called Fastone Image Viewer. And basically I set it up like this so that it's a three-panel window. In the top left-hand corner, I've got a directory tree. I can browse to different folders. On the right-hand side, I see thumbnails of folders and images within folders. And if I select one of those folders, as I've done here with the blue outline, then I get a preview of the image in this bigger window on the left here. And if I double click on the image, then I get a full-sized image in the window, and then I can just go back to the browser, or I can use these buttons right here to go forwards and backwards through the series to view the pictures. And you notice that this is a trip to India, and I clearly took along Bob Harris with his drone, because this is clearly a drone picture of the Taj Mahal. So thanks for that, Bob. You're a trooper. Either that, or I stole it from the internet. I don't remember which one's correct. So if you're looking for an alternative program for a Windows app, one of the things you can look at, we looked at before, was this, or I think we looked at before, is this website called Alternative 2. So I basically type in Fasto, and it finds Fasto and Image Viewer. I click on that, and you'll be everybody will be glad to see that Irfan View is an alternative to Fasto and Viewer, but you will notice that it's only available for Windows, and I need an app that's good for Linux. So one of the ones it's suggesting is this XNView multi-platform, because it has Mac, Windows, and Linux versions. And I've actually used this program before, but I'll just show you that it's available in the Software Manager, which is the direct link to the Mint repository. And I can just search for XNView in the window here, and then when it finds the program, I can just click on Install. And generally, that would just install the program. But in this case, you'll notice that it has a whole bunch of what they call dependencies. Not only do I have to download and install XNView, I have to download a whole bunch of other things, which are all predefined. I don't have to worry about them. I just have to say continue over here, and it will download and install everything. And when I run it, you'll see I've got a similar kind of setup, but not really like I had before, but if I drill down into the menu, you can see that I've got my same three-panel setup that I had with Fastom. I've got my directory tree, I've got my thumbnails, and the preview is kind of taking this whole bottom window. What I can do is I can just kind of drag this window across and stick it underneath the thumbnails, and now I've got exactly the same layout that I had with the Windows app. And again, if I double click on my app there, it brings it up full screen, full window. So the XNView app essentially works exactly the same as the Fastone app in Windows. So for my purposes, I am quite happy to put a big green tick against digital image management. I have an alternative which does exactly the job that I want it to. So next time we'll carry on and look at something else on the list here. In the meantime, a question came into the suggestion box. Why do I get a 505 email error? And Chris has got a few thoughts on that.
Yeah, so 505 error code in SMTP world, and I pasted in the link to Wikipedia on that if you want to look up all of the return codes the server can send you. 500 series errors are all permanent failures. They're basically telling the sender, don't bother trying again, it's going to fail again. So 400 series errors are transient errors that maybe if you try again later on, it might work, you know, full mailbox or something like that, or, you know, something is just not available at the time or whatever. So 500 series errors are permanent failures, but there's no such thing as a 505 error. Okay. It's not a standard email error code. And so it's not part of the SMTP specification. So, I went looking around a little bit, and turns out some people are saying it could be actually a scam. There is a URL there, and I pasted that into the chat as well, where a person thought that if the email actually includes some link in it, in this non-delivery report saying, you know, click here to fix the problem, they were getting ones where it was being brought to a phishing page where you're being told, okay, log into your email account to fix this problem. But it was a scammer's website, and so you were passing on your credentials for your email to some scammer. So there is that potential that this is actually a scam, and I would not click a link in a non-delivery report that claims to be able to fix the problem. So there were some indications that a 505 code is being used by some mail systems for anything suspected of spamming. It's not part of the specification for SMTP mail, but some people were saying that there are mail servers that are starting to use that. So if you get one of these, you can't fix it directly. Okay, it's one of those things, it's not you, it's them. Okay, so it turns out that it is your the receiving mail server, who you are sending mail to, that is blocking mail from your ISP's mail server. So you never, or in most cases, you're not sending mail directly from your computer to the recipient mail server. You're sending it to your internet service provider's mail server. It is then sending the mail on from there to the receiving mail server. So that's what's being blocked, is the connection from your internet service provider's mail server to the recipient mail server. It can get blocked for a number of reasons. So they might suspect that there's a lot of spam or bad activity coming from your internet service provider, so they'll just block any mail coming from it. It's a pretty heavy hammer approach to it, but it's been done. So if there's detections like that going on, that somebody just determines that your internet service provider is spamming the world, they might just decide, we don't want any mail from you. So you can complain to your internet service provider. They may be able to contact the other mail server and say, why are you blocking us? Because they're probably affecting a lot of customers. It's up to them, really, to connect to that other mail server and say, why are you blocking us? Please unblock us. It's an error. We're actually a legitimate company or whatever, but you can't fix it. So, and then this is, I don't know, Alan, do you want to speak to this one? This is an actual case in point that you ran across.
Yeah, actually, a friend sent me an email and I tried to reply to it, and I got this 5054 error, service unavailable. But notice it says the client host is blocked. So it's basically what Chris is talking about. So I just basically raised a trouble ticket with Tuny Hosting, which is my web host and my mail server host, and basically complained. And sure enough, Chris is pointing out here that if you do a DNS lookup on this thing, it's actually Tuny that's being blocked by the recipient host system. So yes. They basically said they would contact them, and I get a reply back on my trouble ticket saying one of their server IPs was backlisted and they've had it released. This is actually the second time this has happened to me, and the first time they put it down to another user on their system who had been caught sending lots and lots of spam, and that had caused one of their IPs to be blocked, and so they'd have to unblock it and basically threw the guy off the system. So that's certainly one possibility for that. Now there's a second issue on emails.
Yeah, so this was one that came in to the suggestion box, and somebody who was traveling outside of Canada, and they were using a mail client that was installed on their computer as opposed to just web-based mail, and they were not able to send or receive mails from Simpatico, which was their internet service provider. So even though they had the proper credentials to log on to their mailbox and send and receive mail, they were getting errors anytime they tried to do that. And so this is something Alan sussed out. So Alan, do you want to talk to that at all?
Yeah, if you look up, something like I can't send mail internationally, and you find a reply from Bell, it will take you to a troubleshooting page, and it basically says, just use webmail. It's kind of odd. I don't understand why webmail works and a client doesn't, but that's basically what they'll tell you.
Yeah. I think what it is they think that the non-web-based mail, you are doing a direct connection to their Popper MIMAP server or their SFTP server when you're sending mail. And I'm assuming that they've decided that their servers are being attacked and abused by people outside of Canada, and most of their customers, their legitimate customers, are not outside of Canada. So they've just decided that they'll block any of those connections. And, of course, they have to leave their web-based mail available. And so that is the solution, is using web-based mail if you're outside of Canada. And I suspect that they have thought about this, and they're not about to change it. So you could complain to them if you're a simpatico customer and you're affected by this, but I really wouldn't expect them to actually change it. And this is one... TELUS was doing the same thing, Alan found. And so, again, it's the sort of thing. I think that ISPs are just getting abused on their servers by so many hackers from outside of the country that are probably not their customers. And so they've just decided to block them.
And in this case, they say the best solution is to use another provider.
Yeah. This is that's not TELUS telling them to do that, but that's a if you use something like Gmail or something like that, you won't have this problem, because Gmail is international by its very nature, and so they're not about to block connections that are coming from Taiwan or Zambodia, anywhere. So that is one solution for sure, is to use Gmail, which you can use with Pop and IMAP, so you can use regular mail clients as well as the web-based mail.
Tom's suggesting using a VPN.
Yeah, that would work. Well, it should work. Now, I suspect that it would go through, but there is the potential that an internet service provider could detect that it's coming from a VPN and block it as well, but I doubt that they would do that. If you had a VPN and you used a server that is within Canada, then that could certainly do it. Tristan comments, best to never use ISP mail. It makes it harder to change providers. I've always recommended that. So if you go and sign up with Simpatico, and you can get a simpatico.ca address. And if you're a Rogers customer, you can get a rogers.com address. But if you start using that widely and you decide, well, I want to switch from, Rogers to Bell or whatever, you have to think about, I've got this address that's no longer going to be valid, and you have to start telling everybody to no longer use that particular address. So if you use the ones like, outlook.com, Gmail, Yahoo, although somebody commented on the fact that it was AOL, I think, that is going away. If you use any of the ones that are fully transportable, like Google or Outlook or whatever, you probably will never have to change your email address just because you changed your internet service provider.
And the other way to do it is to create to purchase your own domain name, host it on a web server, and then you'll have a personal email address which is transportable anywhere to any new host.
Yep.
But that's a bit complex, but it's possible to do. Yep. Okay, we're running a couple of minutes over time, but we've got this interesting question from Chris.
Oh, yes.
So we're going to go back to the question of, is anybody running Windows 11, and what are your thoughts? And while you're racing for your microphone or the chat window, I told you that I'm not upgrading to Windows 11 because none of my computers will do.
Yeah. So the poll is up. So I'm curious, as to, it's not going to be scientific by any stretch of the imagination. We're not going to publish the results or anything like that. But I am curious how many people have actually gone to Windows 11. And I see none yet on the yes, which I'm not really terribly surprised by. And I do wonder if anybody has any comments just that they want to share with the rest of the group on moving towards Windows 11. Is there something compelling in it that you think of? Or is it all stuff that you would rather just avoid?
Well, Hey, come on, people. Somebody's got to have a computer that's compatible with Windows 11.
Well, no, that's the...
Several people have, but they're not interested in Windows 11. Okay.
That's right.
That's fair enough.
Oh, we've got one that is on Windows 11. So they've updated Windows. The one who said yes, I mean, do you mind sharing as to why you decided that it was worth doing? Or was it by accident that you said, yes, do the upgrade? Tom says Windows 11 has a bottom taskbar only. Yeah, a lot of people have complained about that. Susan says, my only worry is that I don't go in the time... In a timely version, it will no longer be free. And that's true. Now, Microsoft has not promised how long the free upgrade will be available. Now, I suspect there will be a fair amount of notice. So if you're only worried about that, I would just let it go until such time as Microsoft says, okay, you've got 2 months or whatever to do that.
Doesn't currently meet minimum system, but you can do the PC health check and it might fix it. Do you think that's true?
No, it won't fix it. What it will do is tell you where it's deficient, and then you might be able to fix it. So, for example, if you didn't have enough RAM, but everything else was fine, you could do that. But in most cases, you're going to find that it's the CPU is not supported. And most people are not going to swap out their motherboard or something like that to get that compatibility.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if it's telling you it's not, if it tells you it's not compatible, then I wouldn't even pursue it. So, Allison said, just scroll off on me. I see it available as an update on my Surface, but haven't upgraded yet. That's what I got on my desktop computer, is that it's ready for me to install, and it seems to be bugging me every now and then that it's something I really want.
Michelin says Windows 11 is good for 12th gen Intel CPUs. I think it's also good for 8th gen, I know, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's 8th and up on Intel, and I forget what it is on the AMD side, but there's a minimum level on that as well. Tristan says, generally with Microsoft, give it 6 months before moving to their new OS, let others get the kinks out. I think by and large, people haven't been having major problems with it. You might argue with the change in functionality or the change in the look and feel and things like that, but the word is out on all of those. And so you can go and you can see reasons not to upgrade and reasons to upgrade. And I think it's a pretty stable operating system, though. So I really think that, just holding off to get kinks out is probably not a huge deal at this point in time. But who knows?
Well, a couple of comments here that if you are going to move up, then make a disk image backup so you can always roll it back.
Yeah, because you're limited on the rollback. Once you install it, I think it's only 7 days now that you have to do a rollback through its own built-in functionality. After that, the only way that you're going to be able to do a rollback is if you either rebuild it from scratch on a Windows 10 or if you've got an image backup from before the update and then roll it back that way. So, and anytime I do an OS upgrade at that sort of level, even if I know that I want it, I do an image backup just so that if something goes south halfway through, I can at least get back to a working computer and, fairly quickly, and then worry about trying to figure out what went wrong.
Saying, if you have P and E cores, as in 12th gen, you need Windows 11.
I would doubt that.
Well, I don't know. Anyway, Jocelyn says, and the poll results are, drum roll.
Oh, yeah, okay, sorry, yeah, I'll do the end poll and share results, and there we go. So,
95% no, I think.
Yeah, nobody,
only one person says yes.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's pretty telling, and I think Microsoft may have a bit of a fight on their hands in getting people to upgrade to Windows 11. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, so, anybody should be thinking about upgrading to Linux.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not surprised at all, and I think it may give a bunch of support to Linux for sure.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap up. We're going to skip over any other questions. If you have any other questions, send them to suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we'll run them through next week's Q&A. Next Monday at 3:30, Lawrence is going to be giving a library presentation with the Tech Cafe series on scam avoidance and trust. And finally, our next Q&A is next Wednesday, the 24th. And there's the address to send your questions and shares to. So I hope everybody enjoyed that. We're about 10 minutes over time, but I thought it was a fun night. So yep. Thanks for attending, everyone, and goodbye from me.
Thanks very much, folks. We'll see you next week.